Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to It's Rainmaking Time. This is Kim Greenhouse. All of us are worried about what's happening in the Gulf Coast, but few of us understand what's happening geologically. We don't get accurate reports. We're getting bits and pieces of information. We need to talk to somebody who can explain this to us. Chris Landau, who's a geologist and also a meteorologist by trade, is here to explain to us what is happening. He has participated in oil and gas rigs, and he's done over 50. He has been involved in water well drilling. You can read his work on Op-Ed News. On an emergency level, I think we need to understand how serious what's happening is and what information we need to know and to share with our friends and loved ones and associates that needs to be focused on. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome Chris Landau to It's Rainmaking Time. Thank you for being here.
Hi, Kim. Thank you very much.
My pleasure. Chris, what do we need to know as citizens of the United States, and what does the world need to know about what's really happening?
Well, the most serious event is that we have a well in the Gulf of Mexico with a probable blown-out formation and a blown-out casing, and the cement has damaged, and the oil and gas is probably coming through the sea floor, according to Senator Bill Nelson, who announced that a few days ago from Florida. The directional wells that they're drilling down to 18,000 feet will have no effect in sealing the well, because they're putting mud and cement in a blown-out formation, blown-out casing. What that means is that if you have a car tire with 50 holes in it and you try and pump air into it, and these are big holes, we all know that the air is going to go straight out the tire. The picture that they're giving us of the well is also a textbook picture that you would get when you were in primary school, say age 8-10 years of age, where we've got one layer that they're drilling down to with the directional wells. There are probably 50 layers from 5,000 feet down to 18,000 to 20,000 feet. And I've been asking in my articles for the last 2-3 weeks and perhaps longer for them to publish the mud logs. The mud logs are our evidence, the forensic evidence of what actually happened on this drilling rig. They will tell us the mud weight they used, whether they were using water-based mud or oil-based mud. I assume they were using oil-based mud because they were drilling offshore. And what was the density of the mud at the bottom when the well blew out? They were having problems controlling the gas coming out the well. But what we've got to really look forward to here is an endless supply of oil and gas into the Gulf at, who knows, 60,000 barrels per day plus. And there's nobody with a plan in force and no proposed plan to stop it. When you put mud and cement into a well, when you drill that well, you drill with mud, and the purpose of the mud is to keep the hole open while you're drilling the well, and also to bring the cuttings of a chopped-up rock to the surface. The mud serves two purposes, as I said, bring the gas up so that the mud-logging geologist can tell at what layers he's getting oil and gas. And then it also just keeps the oil and gas out of the well while you're drilling. If you remove the mud, the oil and gas comes roaring out of the well, and you have explosions on the surface as happened. So the big thing is you need to keep the mud weight up. You need to keep on putting barium sulfate, or in heavy wells, hematite sulfate, iron sulfate into the well to keep that oil and gas out of the well while you're drilling. Only once you've produced the well or you've finished with a well do you put a steel piping in from top to bottom, and then you blast holes in that piping once you've sealed it all with cement at various layers, starting at the bottom of the well, and then over a period of months or years, cementing in the well from the bottom to the top. So it's very controlled once the well is finished. But if you have, while you're drilling and you're putting too much barium sulfate into the well, you can have a density greater than the rock, and you can blow out that well. In other words, you push the barium sulfate and the drilling mud into the formation, and then you lose the drilling mud instantly, and the hole becomes empty, and the gas and oil come roaring out of the hole. So you've got to have a fine balance between not too much mud weight and not too little. Too little, and the gas also comes out, and the oil comes out. Too much, you blow out the formation, and it all comes out. I'll stop there for a moment. Kim?
In your article, you talk about the distinction between new oil and old oil, and why is this important that we know this?
For years, we've been taught, and I was taught as a geologist and growing up, that oil is from plankton, you know, buried under heat and pressure, and basically it's going to last a certain length of time until the reservoir where it was created underground is emptied, and oil is very old. We've been taught that, and parts of the oil is very old. It was created a long time ago. But there's also theories that were put out originally by the Russians back in the 50s and by the guy who did the periodic table, Mendeleev, Dmitry Mendeleev, who thought that oil and gas were inorganic. And when I began to log wells for the period of 2006 to 2007, I began to question when I noticed the oil and gas above, below and inside calcareous sandstone horizons that didn't seem to make sense. These zones were not the traps. They were actually the creation zones for oil and gas. And when you have fault zones through that area, you increase more hydrogen sulfide to the rock formation, and the hydrogen sulfide acts as a reductant, and it reduces calcareous formations and carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide to oil and gas. It starts by reducing them to methane, and methane combines with sodium chloride to form methyl chlorides, and you string the methyl chlorides together to form methyl ethyl butyl pentyl chlorides, and eventually the chlorides are dropped and you have the pentane molecules, or you have N-alkanes or paraffin molecules. So this is called the Wirtz synthesis. I didn't invent it, I just recognized it, and salt domes contribute towards oil and gas formation. The other good process is called the Fischer-Tropsch process, which is done in South Africa. 30% of South Africa's oil is produced by the Fischer-Tropsch process of taking carbon monoxide and water and heating that under great pressure to create alkanes, again, stringing these methane, ethane, propane molecules together to get to pentane, and then trimethylpentane to form octane, which is our gasoline. So there are quite a few methods of creating oil and gas inorganically, and I believe coal is also inorganic. Those are my theories. They're not part of mainstream geology, and there are probably 5 to 10% of geologists that believe it. I believe in the eastern part of the world, in the Russia and that area, Sweden, there are many more people that believe it. I've written my papers and published them in 2008 and 2009 with the American Institute of Petroleum Geologists. These are peer-reviewed papers, and with the Association of Engineering Geologists. On my theories, they're available on the internet. You can go to opednews.com and put in Chris Lando, C-H-R-I-S-L-A-N-D-A-U, and look at it. The main situation which makes it interesting is that if this oil is new oil, that means it's being created right now. That means it's 10, 20, 50, 100 years old. That oil's going to go on forever. It's never going to stop. If it's old oil, let's say it's highly pressurized old oil and it's a couple of million years old, that's fine too, but it's highly pressurized oil and it's still going to go on for a few years. So we need to drill relief wells into the surrounding area. 8 wells I've suggested, maybe they'll need more, and depressurize the area, get the oil and gas out. We know we can't stop the oil and gas coming out of the well, So if we can't stop it, recognize that we can't stop it and get it out and pipe it to the coast. Get it out because it's just polluting the Gulf and killing us and killing the animals.
What do you think is the mindset that is obstructing a whole systems approach like what you're talking about?
I have no idea, Kim. You tell me. I'd love to know. I don't know. There are no other solutions that I've heard. I've heard of silly things like atomic blasts, which is just going to blow the formation open and release more oil and gas and create a catastrophe. I have no idea why they won't follow a solution that's a simple and the only logical solution that I can think of. As I've said, when you drill into a hole which is empty and they try to do this top kill procedure where they try to put drilling mud into the well, but there were too many holes in that well, and you can only seal something if you've got back pressure. You've got to drive the oil and gas out of the formation to let the cement set in a quiet zone. You can't have roaring gas and oil roaring past and try and ask that cement to set. So when they go down with the directional wells, we're all waiting with bated breath for two wells that are not going to work. As soon as the wells enter the existing blowout well, all the mud is going to be lost down those wells, and you'll have two more blowout wells. We only hope that the blowout protectors work. Otherwise, they're in more trouble. You can't drill into a blown-out area, blown-out wells, unsealed well, and expect to get away with it. It just doesn't work.
You say in your article that the public really does not understand that deep water drilling is not just where the problems have arisen, that it's about high-pressure oil and gas drilling that creates the problems. Of the millions of wells drilled, you say, there are thousands of ticking time bomb high-pressure wells in existence, and new ones are being drilled every day. New risks are being taken every day.
Sure. This has been going on for a very long time. I've worked personally on about 50 high-pressure wells here, and when you start logging as a logging geologist, they're very nervous about letting you on a site to log at high-pressure wells because your job is to watch the mud weight like crazy. You have to monitor that mud weight for every minute that you're there. If things go wrong, they go wrong quickly, as you saw there, and everything blows out. So you have to, when you know you've got extra high pressure, you have to case that well with thousands and thousands of feet of casing. The one I worked on, we put in 8,000 feet of casing and drilled with inside that, but we allowed the cement to set over a period of a week before we went back to go carry on working on it. And it depends on whether they cut corners, whether they cement that whole section of casing. If they only put in cement halfway down to save money, it all depends on how much the investors want to spend and how much they want to save costs. So the job has to be done when you drill on high-pressure wells, and that's probably less than 5% of the wells. You have to do it well, and obviously corners were cut here or a shoddy job was done.
How many people do you think in your position who know what you know and have the experience that you do are looking at this saying the same thing that you're saying and frustrated and upset, who actually have the capacity to get in and do something but are being prevented or just don't have the access to do it?
I'm surprised that many, many more geologists and mud logging geologists don't come forward and say something about it. I'm actually shocked because they're all working on the drilling rigs. They know exactly what I'm saying. They've done it in the past. And I think the fear for losing your jobs, I don't work in the oil and gas industry anymore, so I don't care. But the fear of them losing their jobs must be so great, and the buddy-buddy business of once you're out, once you rat out the oil and gas industry, you're gone, you'll never get a job there again, I think is what is keeping them from saying anything. And I find it disgusting when the Gulf of Mexico is dying that no other geologists and mud logging geologists and petroleum engineers who know exactly what I'm saying come forward and say, hey, Chris Lander's talking rubbish, or Chris Lander's not making sense, or hey, we've got another solution, we can do it this way. We have nothing. The silence is classically like the oil and gas industry. Say nothing and hope the problem goes away. Just keep quiet, say nothing, and eventually people will get tired of it and go away. But they've created such a big mess here, no one can go away ever again.
When this is solved, it's only the first of a succession of efforts that have to be put in place to preserve all the other deep wells that don't have the way secured so that this doesn't happen in all the other wells, correct?
Sure, you've got to be careful. In every well that you drill, you've got to be careful. You've got to put in cement. You've got to put in enough casing. You've got to put in maybe double and triple layers of casing to make sure that you've done a good job. You've got to put in cement all the way. You can't put in cement for 1,000 or 2,000 feet and say, hey, that's going to hold up. It held in 90% of the previous cases. We only have 1% or 0.5% blowouts. What the hell? We'll take a chance.
Let's talk about the forensics. The forensics that you talked about. What did you call it? Something dog? Mud dog?
Logs. L-O-G-S.
Mud logs.
Mud log is a working two-dimensional piece of paper. As a mudlogging geologist, you log the formation, you look at the bits of sample that are coming up, the crushed rock, and you put that down, whether it's sandstone or mudstone or limestone, and you record that every foot of the well. You make sure you know your formation well. At the same time, you record the rate of penetration going down the well, how fast you're going down in that well, see if it's soft or hard. And then you also record at what depth you're striking gas. The gas comes up while you're drilling. And as it comes up, there's a lot of gas. You warn the mud man to weight up the mud to keep it down. And you look for drilling at a background gas of 30 to 50 units, which is about 50 units is about 1% gas. 5,000 units is about 100% gas. So you try and keep your gas coming up, your background gas, not the spikes as you intersect different layers of gas, but you try and keep the background gas at a little less than 1%, half a percent to 1% coming up a well. And the mud logs, we have recorded all of that. They tell you what bits you used, how much casing you used, what the problems were at 10,000 feet, 11,000, 12, 15, 20,000 feet. What happened? How much casing you put in? How much cement? How long you were out the hole? It's all recorded there. It's all the forensic evidence of what actually happened, what went wrong. Let's publish the mud logs for the whole world to see.
Absolutely. Bring it open source. Open source the whole thing. That's how things get resolved in a quicker way. Continue.
Right. So they're there. The mud logs are there. And when you finish the well, you get what's called the e-logs, the electronic logs, where people like Halliburton or Schlumberger, the two main people in the world who do the electronic logs, who run a sophisticated instrument down the well and check at various layers. Geologist says, hey, there's gas at 10,324 feet. And the e-logs guys are going to confirm, yes, that is gas, that is oil, but it's full of salt water. Hey, we can't use that one. That's a useless layer. Thanks for finding it, but it doesn't work. Okay, so we go on to the next layer. And we find more oil and we find more gas at that layer. What do the e-logs say? At that layer, they say, hey, it's porous, it looks good, but for this reason or that reason, it's not going to work. So in combination, those two, the electronic logs, which cost them a lot to run, and Halliburton and Schlumberger are the two people that run those logs, the two main people, the other companies. And they produce these things. BP have got those. The logs, the mud logs, are also emailed to shore every 6 to 12 hours to BP, to the Department of Oil and Gas, to many, many geologists and background people who are on the email list who are receiving information for that well, as I've said, every 6 to 12 hours. And the mud reports go in every 6 to 12 hours, and the company man report goes in every 6 to 12 hours. And so it's all documented, it's all backed up multiple times, and the evidence is all there. We need that evidence brought to the fore so we can solve the problem. If the main problem is a blown-out formation, a blown-out well that can't be sealed, which I suspect it is, let us know. We know that anyway. It looks like it's a blown-out well that can't be sealed, and the oil and gas is probably coming up through the floor next to the well and along a whole lot of cracks that are radiating away from that well. So forget about the well. If we can't see it, recognize it and move on and drill some other decent wells into the area. Watch the mud weight. Case them correctly as you go. Put in enough cement and get the oil and gas out of the area. Whether the oil is old oil or new oil, solve the problem. nobody's solving the problem.
Have you tried to call anybody in the government?
Yeah, I've called. I've called Senator Bill Nelson. I've sent emails and stuff to President Obama. At the moment, there's been no response.
Yeah, it's pretty tightly controlled. Talk about abiotic oil. What is that?
Abiotic oil, as I've stated already, is the inorganic synthesis of oil, gas, and coal by reduction methods on calcareous formations and on carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. Basically, on the surface of the Earth, you have carbon, and what happens with carbon, it gets oxidized to carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. You burn anything, you take methane gas on your stove and you oxidize that methane gas or propane or butane, and basically you make carbon dioxide and carbon monoxide. Every chemical process is reversible. So if you take that water and carbon dioxide and you reverse it, you can't do it under normal temperatures and pressures, but you reverse that process, you go carbon dioxide plus water and you go backwards to methane gas. So it's a reverse process, and that reverse process takes place underground where you're rich in hydrogen and poor in oxygen. So you're rich in hydrogen and sulfur there, and you start stringing metal compounds together to make long chains, to make straight chains and cyclical chains and aromatics, which are the various carbon compounds. And along with, as I've said, with salt and saline solutions under the Wurtz synthesis, you make oil and gas.
Why is abiotic oil relevant in the context of what's going on?
Abiotic oil is relevant because if it is new oil, that supply in some places is inexhaustible. It's being created now. There's many theories that the one oil well in Saudi Arabia that's been going, I believe, since the 1930s, I forget the name, something like Ghanwar or something like that, has been, I don't know how many million barrels it produces a week or whatever, but this one oil well that is found is an abiotic source, and I believe the Russians have got a few as well. It produces huge quantities of oil, and obviously at that amount that's being produced, it's not running out. Whenever tests are done on oil, oil is found to be young. In other words, you can only test to 100,000 years with carbon dating. And so the tests that are done are basically ignored. People say, well, the oil is contaminated. You contaminated the results. There was something that came into the results and contaminated, therefore the results are wrong. Therefore, it should be older. It should be as old as the formation. If the formation is a billion years old, it should be a billion years old. But that's not true. You must accept the face value of the results. So if you get five universities to test the oil, separate universities today, they'll probably find the oil, who knows, 1,000 years to 50,000 years of age. I don't know.
All right, now a difficult question. Do you think that there was deep drilling into a fault line?
I don't know. I assume so. I haven't a clue. One would have to look at the results. Again, you could go to the petroleum engineer, and they would have sonar type scans, which they would have done geophysical type scans, which would show a three dimensional picture of why they chose that spot that they did, and in that three dimensional scan, the faults would show up, and those fault zones are probably producing the oil and gas in the quantity that they are. But all one would have to do is call for the sonar scans, if there are gravitational ones and magnetic scans, to call for all of them and have a look at the 3D images of those scans. Again, they're on record, they're there. We need them published so everybody can see what has happened. And once we recognize what's happened, let's move on and fix it.
I think that there's an interesting, tragic but interesting process that is going on in terms of the human side of how this is being dealt with, meaning that because this happened accidentally and it's so bad, there's an effort to try to cover how bad it is.
Yes.
And yet what happens paradoxically is it gets worse if they would open it up and actually reveal the level of it, everybody could participate in bringing through the solution. And as you said, it could get done quicker. But because they don't want to face that and they don't want to participate in the transparency, it's getting worse and worse and worse. Now, you said something that made me very sad, among the other things you've said, which is that the men and women that are out there right now who are working on this in the Gulf are very likely to get cancer. Explain why.
Okay, there's in normal gasoline, we've got the following compounds and oil compounds. Some of them, there are probably about 200 in crude oil, but some of them would be pentane, hexane, heptane, octane, decane, dodecane, tetradecane, 2-methylpropane, 2-methylbutane, 2-methylpentane, 3-methylpentane, 2-methylhexane, 2.2-dimethylpentane, 2,2,3-trimethylbutane, 2,2,4-trimethylpentane, cyclopentane, methylcyclopentane, cyclohexane, methylcyclohexane, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, metazoline, paraxylene, and orthoxylene, 3-ethyltoluene, 1,3,5-trimethylbenzene, 1,2,4-trimethylbenzene. Those are some of the products, not all of the products in crude oil. That's the lighter fraction of the products. As we all know, benzene is highly carcinogenic. Anybody can go onto any website and find how much stuff has been written on benzene, how carcinogenic it is. Benzene is in all of our gasoline today. It's still being used as one of the compounds within the 30, 50, 200 compounds that make up gasoline. And these things are going to be breathed in through the air, and people are going to get sick from them.
Aren't people already getting sick from it?
I believe they are. And the concentrations don't have to be particularly high for you to smell or taste them or to have the results of how bad they are. They're usually something like 2.3 parts per million, 1.5 parts per million. OSHA have got a whole lot of Occupational Safety and Health Administration have got a whole lot of data on the various chemicals. So, for example, on ethylbenzene, they say it's immediately dangerous to life and health at 846 parts per million. And then you can smell, say, ethylbenzene at 2.3 parts per million. If you take benzene, you can smell it at 1.5 parts per million. You can taste it at 2 parts per million in the water. And that's at 1 part per million is enough to already make you feel sick. So, yeah, these things are all in the stuff, and it's just uncontrolled release of vast amounts of these toxic chemicals. I wish we could make the CEOs of BP, Transocean, and Halliburton come and clean it all up, make them sit there every day, and breathe the stuff in and get cancer, because it's going to cause a lot of cancer for a lot of people.
How come it is that when I think about oil and gas drilling, I never think of it happening in the ocean? And I wonder how many people never think that that goes on in the ocean. I only associate that type of work on land.
Yes, you don't work in the industry.
When you think of drilling, a lot of what comes to our mind, I'm sure it's not just me, is land. It's happening on land. I had no idea. I feel like there's a huge gap in my education. I had no idea there was deep water drilling.
Deep water drilling all over the world. This is just one of the places in the world that's being done. It's actually being done everywhere, off Australia, off Brazil, off Venezuela, off you name it, it's being done. Angola, Nigeria, it just goes on and on. It's where the great well sources are, and that's probably due to the reduction of calcareous formations, which are abundant in the sea through the process of fault zones and hydrogen sulfide and reducing conditions to convert those calcareous formations to oil. So that's why it's such a profitable business to do it in the sea, because the starting material, the material to reduce to oil, is there in abundance in the sea.
I'm surprised that the safety measures are not very strict for what can and can't be done under the sea.
I think they are. In a lot of places, they are strict. And and we don't have that many. I know we have many blowouts occurring each year, but for the amount of wells being sunk, we're not having that many reported. That many disasters. We know we're having quite a few per year, and the ones that don't really leak oil all over the ocean, don't get to hear about them, especially if they're far out and nobody sees them. Nobody's going to report them, or people will get a small smack on the wrists and carry on.
What do you think about the dispersants being put in the water?
I think some of them are bad, like the glycols and that, but they're not as bad as the oil. I think what's bad about them is they make the oil miscible. In other words, it's no longer immiscible. It no longer sits on top of the water. It now dissolves in the water. So the dispersants themselves are bad, but not as bad as the toxic stuff in the oil. But what makes them bad is you now have the oil dissolved in the water, and instead of it floating on the top, the fishes and anybody who swims in the water, that's being absorbed through their skin. For the fishes and all the animals in the sea, they're breathing it in through their gills all the time, and it's going through their skin. So it's bad.
I'm so sad.
Floating on top and underneath is bad.
I also read that there's another leak that is asserted to be much bigger, 5 to 6 miles away. Have you heard that?
I've heard something like that. I can't say. You know, to me, that's all theory. I mean, it's all guesswork at this stage. And until we actually see the evidence, until we see the video cameras at work, and we need some private people to go in there and expose it and see what's going on with their private submarines and private vehicles. We know deep water submarines exist, ones that can go down 36,000 feet, you know, with human beings in. That's been done already in the 1960s. So we might as well use that technology to see what's really going on there.
If you could say anything right now, if you could close your eyes and you were in charge of solving the problem, state again what you would do and lay it out. I know you've been talking about it the whole time on the show, but boom, this is what I would do immediately. Let's say we put the hat on you today and you are crowned the person who's in charge of the cleanup and restoration. What happens? What's the first thing you're doing?
I would first get the mud logs and the e-logs published, so we have a two-dimensional and three-dimensional picture of what's going on. Well, we would also get the sonar pictures published as well, so we can see what they drilled into. What did they drill into? Was it a monster fault zone? So we know. I would date the oil. I would then, whether this oil ends up being new oil or old oil, the solution is exactly the same. You've got to drill 8 wells around that existing well, depressurize the area, get the oil out, pipe it to the coast. We can all use the oil in our automobiles. Nothing has changed. So get the oil out of the area, sink wells in. If you sink 8 in, it's not enough, and the oil's still coming through the seafloor. Sink in 20, sink 50, 100. Doesn't really matter. Get the oil out of the area until it's depressurized. If the oil continues to flow, you're just going to have to put in more wells, probably 1,500 feet apart, until that whole area is depressurized and you've taken out as much oil as is being created or the zone is emptying out. It can be done. So I think we must get on with it. It'll take 2 months for a well to go down 20,000 feet, and they must case them properly. They mustn't use Halliburton for the work.
They said they must or they mustn't?
They must not use Halliburton for the work. Halliburton screwed up the cement work there, and we don't need them working on places like this anymore. So they must get people like Schlumberger or other people in so that we can have a solution.
Do you think that who the group is that comes in to correct it is a political thing, like a government contract type thing? And don't you think there's going to be pressure to use a Halliburton, for example?
If they use them, hopefully they will do a better job, that people are watching them at work now. They're still going to continue in the world. They're a giant organization, so they will still continue. So use them, use other people, and get the job done.
I have a very difficult question for you. How would you see to it that the forensics are not being played with? That means the sonar information, the information about the state of these wells that's recorded and already been electronically submitted. How do we make sure that when you get those records, they haven't been altered?
Well, you've got to get the records from multiple people. They've been emailed to multiple people, those logs, and they're usually in PDF format. Of course, we can alter PDF as well, but they're really in PDF format, and they've been sent to many geologists, so you need to get the email list of who they were sent to, and they've been sent to the Department of Oil and Gas as well. So the Department of Oil and Gas isn't going to alter their logs. So get it from all the geologists, all the investors on this well, whether it's BP or outside investors as well, that received copies of the e-logs, mud logs, and get those reports, the company man reports, on a daily basis, not just the final reports. Get the ones that were done for the whole period that they were drilling. You know, every day, every 12 hours, there was a report, and look at them. Compare the ones that when they were drilling to the ones that that were done finally. And there literally are thousands of these reports around, so it would be very difficult to doctor thousands and thousands of reports sent to many different people and organizations.
I really appreciate you taking your time to share your expertise with us and to really give us the inside scoop of what needs to happen and why and what the real state of affairs is. Is there anything else you'd like to say on the show today?
No, thanks, Kim. Just get on with it, and not you specifically, but the world, get on and fix the problem. People are dying. The ecosystem's dying. Do something about it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Many blessings.